This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Now, if you're like me, you probably learned in school that horses first galloped across our continent when the conquistadors brought them across the Atlantic on their ships, right? Well, that's true, sort of, because the other part of the story is that horses some as small as a dog, have been on this continent much longer than we have. I mean, way longer. Their evolutionary origins in North America go back 55 million years. And then around 10,000 years ago, they disappeared, along with a lot of other amazing beasts like mastodons and camels. But when horses set hoof back on this continent and escaped their owners, they ran off into the sunset, as it were. They were remarkably successful at recolonizing their old habit. And today, some 75,000 Mustangs roam the desert valleys and mountain ranges of the American West. And it is a comeback so extraordinary, we don't know how to deal with them. That's the saga. That saga is the subject of a fascinating new book, Wild Horse Country, The History, Myth, and Future of the Mustang. Dave Phillips is the author. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning national correspondent for the New York Times based in Colorado Springs. He joins us from KRCC today. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, you're welcome, man. We actually have an excerpt of your book at sciencefriday.com/wildhorses. And if you've encountered wild Mustangs yourself or you want to weigh in, please give us a call. Our number is 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk, or tweet us at SciFry. You know, Dave, the thing that struck me when I read this book is that wild horses, and as you say, there are tens of thousands of them out there, and they seem to be forgotten somehow. Nowhere, they don't have the fame of the bison or the grizzlies or any of those animals out west.
Well, you know, it's funny. When I first got interested in this subject, I had grown up in the West my entire life, and I was about 25 when I actually learned that there were wild horses, not just a couple, you know, a remnant herd, like carefully curated in a national park or something, but like you said, tens of thousands roaming all over. And what is even more amazing is there used to be literally millions of wild horses in herds that early explorers described as rivaling the buffalo herds. When they came back to North America, they came back in a very big way. Mm-hmm. And what we have left is just sort of a little vestige of that. But it is does pose an interesting problem of what we now do to try and preserve them.
Well, the question to me, and you raised this yourself in the book, is they're out in the remotest desert parts of the country. There's not a lot of green grass to chomp on. How have they survived?
Ira, no green grass to chomp on.
Let me X that out.
So how do they survive is pretty amazing. You can go out to these areas, mostly in the Great Basin areas of Nevada, Utah, Idaho, Arizona, and walk around, and it is mostly thorny brush and bare ground. And yet, hundreds of horses manage to survive out there in these valleys. And it's stunning to see, and I think the answer is that they evolved to do exactly this. They are specifically evolved to eat rough, poor forage that other animals couldn't necessarily thrive on. And so despite a concerted effort by ranchers and the government over decades to get rid of horses, they never did. They just retreated into these harshest areas where they've managed to do pretty well.
They actually developed a very advantageous type of tooth to survive. Tell us about that.
So that's interesting. So as you mentioned, the wild horse started out as something maybe about the size of a small dog back in the early Eocene. And at that time, the entire globe was forest. And it was a little browser that would sort of trot around in the forest and eat leaves and shoots. But then as the world cooled and the forest retreated, horses kind of made an interesting move that allowed them to thrive. And that is that they developed a tooth. The fancy name is hypsodonty. They developed a tooth that sort of keeps growing forever. And the reason they had to do that is that grass is pretty harsh stuff. The reason that we as humans don't eat it is because it actually has silica, sand essentially, built right into its cells. And so if you tried to eat it, very quickly you would run out of teeth. And a lot of these early browsers did run out of teeth if they tried to eat grass, and so they didn't. But the horse and a couple other ungulates did something different. They developed this tooth that, the best way to describe it is like a mechanical pencil. It is a long tooth that is, most of it is deeply embedded in their jaw. But then as it wears down from eating grass, it sort of moves up, you know, and new tooth comes out. And so they can keep eating this stuff and grinding away their teeth for 20, 30 years, which, by the way, is where we get the term long in the tooth. If the grinding molars of a horse are used up, that is long in the tooth, and you know that that horse is not long for this world.
Mm-hmm. A lot of your book is talking about managing the Mustangs and deficiencies in how these Mustangs are managed. You talk about helicopters swoop down and corral them, and then they're taken away by trucks. And what do you see here? What got you interested in this? Yes.
So we preserved the wild horse in the late 60s and early 70s, right when we were preserving all sorts of parts of the natural environment. That's when the Endangered Species Act and the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act were all created. The wild horse had to have its own law because it can't count as an endangered species because it is introduced. It's not a native. We really identified with the wild horse, and let me tell you what I mean. I think that it is probably the most American animal out there. If you think about it, like us, it's an immigrant. Like us, it doesn't have any particularly noble heritage. You know, it's a bunch of ragtag folks who just happen to get kicked out by more respectable groups. And because of that, it really became sort of the symbol of freedom and a kind of low-born nobility that we really think of as ourselves. Okay, so we wanted to preserve that idea, that symbol of our democracy. And at the same time, we wanted to preserve these animals, which were being rounded up and sent to the slaughterhouse to the point of extinction. And we never have really figured out how to make the idea of the horse as a symbol of freedom and the practical biology of protecting and yet limiting this horse work. And so we've gotten ourselves into this situation where, like you said, we have 75,000 horses now on the range. And by the way, that's about three times as many as the government says can be sustained on the range that's left to them. We have another 45,000 horses that we've removed through helicopter roundups. And unable to find anything else to do with them, have put them in essentially like government long-term storage, which practically means that we are paying someone in the Midwest a heck of a lot of money, about $50 million a year, to take care of these horses until we figure out what we should do with them. And we've been doing that for about 25 years.
Mm-hmm. And so we're just storing the horses until we can figure out what to do with them. Why are they rounded up? Why don't we just leave them in the wild?
Well, let me tell you, first of all, that this is a rather controversial point, and not everyone's going to agree with it. But I'll give you the official line. If we leave too many horses out on the range, they will essentially eat the Western Desert down to dust, they say. There's no longer the predators that could control these populations in any easy way. And therefore, we have to round up and remove the excess. Now, for a long time, what the BLM wanted to do is when it rounded up horses, it wanted to adopt them out. But it's never been able to find enough people who would like to adopt and train a wild horse. It's not expensive, but it is difficult. And so they're always left essentially with a surplus, for lack of a better word. And now they've gotten to a point, they've gotten into this sort of this addict's dilemma where they're now spending so much money on storing horses that they can't invest money in finding alternative means to try and manage them, which is sort of like not being able to go to rehab because you're spending all your money on heroin. And they have gotten to a point where now they can't even afford to round up horses on the range to try and protect the range. The whole system is kind of ground to a halt. Mm-hmm. And so that 75,000 this year may very well be 95,000 next year and grow at about a 15% rate until it collapses.
Mm-hmm. You point out that in other countries, people serve horses for dinner in restaurants, but we wouldn't do that here because they're so iconic.
Well, really true. And we are also not the only country with a large wild horse population. Australia has 500,000 wild horses. They call them Brumbies. And in fact, there, you are allowed as a citizen, if you're living out in some of these rural cattle ranching areas, to shoot them. In fact, the government, even in the past, has provided pamphlets on how to best do this. But politically here, none of that is really viable.
So are we just basically stuck in a political gridlock on this?
Well, that's been the case pretty much since they have been protected in the 1970s. What I found, though, is potentially interesting and a neat solution is, and if you are a land management person who's about to take a sip of this coffee, put it down because I'm going to say something to make you really angry. I think an interesting solution is mountain lions. Now, when I say this, it instantly marks me as a really naive neophyte in the world of managing wild horses, because for literally generations, the government and all its experts have said, not only are there not any mountain lions around really to do that, but mountain lions couldn't hunt a big wild horse out in the open anyway. So it's a non-starter. Move on. This is not Wild Kingdom. But what I found when I was reporting this book is that I started looking through some of the research literature, and there have been all sorts of biologists out in the field that have gone to study something or other about mountain lions or something or other about wild horses, and their data got totally interrupted because way too many mountain lions were eating way too many wild horses. And so the data is there. It's just that there is an unwillingness to look at it. And I talk a little bit in the book about how you wouldn't need big numbers of mountain lions to make a huge difference in sustainably managing the horse population.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are folks who I asked people who've seen them and are working with them to call in. Let's go to Simone in Phoenix. Hi, Simone.
Hi there. How are you doing? Thank you so much for having me on.
Go ahead.
Well, there's not really a particular question that I have for you, but I was just wondering, you know, if you guys would like some input on how we manage wild horses every day.
Do you have wild horses? Where do they come from?
Well, so these wild horses are actually owned by all of the public of America, and they are the Salt River Wild Horses, and we are the Salt River Wild Horse Management Group, and I'm the president of the group. So perhaps you've heard of us when the Forest Service was trying to remove the Salt River Wild Horses approximately 2 years ago. And it was really the public of Arizona who gave them their voice, and which is the reason why we were able to come to solutions with the Forest Service. And that's basically the reason why they are still there today.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Dave Phillips is with me. He is author of Wild Horse Country. What do you think, Dave?
What types of things are you guys doing to control the population and keep it sustainable on the land?
So we are a big advocate of birth control, which is called PZP. And PZP is the only birth control that does not influence wild horse behavior, because we actually oppose anything else that does influence wild horse behavior. So
can I jump in and add a little bit more to this?
Sure, go ahead.
Sure.
So this is really an interesting thing that volunteers have been doing across the West, and it's essentially a dart that's given once a year to female horses, and it almost acts like a birth control pill. And so it's reversible. Like she said, it has minimal effect on wild horse behavior. The interesting thing is that the Bureau of Land Management, which is supposed to manage these horses for the federal government, they've been talking about how they're going to turn to using this fertility control drug for almost 30 years. And they never have. In fact, they're using it less now than they did 10 years ago. And the only reason they're using it at all now is because of groups like the group looking at the Salt River herd that essentially volunteer and do it for the government. This is a really neat solution, and I've seen it work, and it's not only better for the horses, it's better for the taxpayer, because you're not stuck with horses that you then have to feed for 30 years that you rounded up.
Quick question from Ann in Napa, California. Hi, Ann.
Hi.
Quick.
Hello.
Go for it.
I just wanted to make the comment that I read about 2 months ago that Trump wants to slaughter all of the Mustangs and wild horses that are, you know, have been rounded up for adoption, as well as slaughtering all of the remaining wild horses that are out in the wild. And he's in the proposed upcoming budget, it'll save, I don't know, $10.4 million supposedly. And he's doing it because of the pressure, again, from the National Cattlemen's Association.
Okay, let me get a comment because we have to go. What do you think of that, Dave? Have you heard about that?
Yeah, this is absolutely correct that there is pressure on the Trump administration to loosen the restrictions on what you can do with horses once they're rounded up. Right now, you cannot buy them and then sell them to a slaughterhouse. I think there are proposals in place to loosen that up, which has happened in the past. Politically, we'll see if that is possible. There are few members in Congress that would openly vote to slaughter wild horses. So it's a matter of whether they could sneak it through or repackage it in a better way. So far, that has not happened in the past several decades, at least in big numbers, although there's been constant pressure to do so.
Mm-hmm. Dave Phillips, great book, Wild Horse Country. It's so easy to read your writing. I congratulate you on writing such a very easily read and very interesting book to read.
Well, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
You can read an excerpt of the book at sciencefriday.com/wildhorses. As I say, really interesting read, something I didn't know about.